Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word podcast dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and I'm here to tell you exactly what I think of some of the latest movies out right now.
So over the last couple of weeks, I've had my specialty shows, the pre-Oscar show, the post-Oscar show, which means not only do I get to review some award-winning and award-nominated films in depth, but it also means I take a little bit of a break from reviewing mainstream films. Well, that break is over, and I have a lot of catching up to do. As a matter of fact, there are some films that I saw during the Christmas break, right before New Year's Day 2024, that I still haven't reviewed on this show yet. And I'm going to wait until they get an official Blu-ray or 4K release before I actually review them, because otherwise I don't have any other reason to review them on this show. So I've got some brand new films to review for you, some that aren't quite as new, but they've still made a considerable amount of money at the box office, so I will eventually review them for you later on in the show. First, though, the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. This is the fourth film in the Ghostbusters series, if you don't count the 2016 Ghostbusters movie that was also frustratingly called Ghostbusters. I could go on and on about my frustration with either sequels or reimaginings of movies that have the exact same title as the original film. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to waste your time, because Ghostbusters Frozen Empire does not fall under that category. To its credit, it does have a different name, but as I was watching the film, I was kind of wondering if another Ghostbusters film was entirely necessary. I know that the Ghostbusters franchise is a franchise that means a lot to a lot of people. When you have three out of the four original Ghostbusters still alive and still acting, it seems a no-brainer to put them in the same movie together as their iconic characters from the films from the 80s. But Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, to me, and I'll get into why it didn't really work for me, but I could see a lot of effort being put into it. Obviously, the people who made the film, especially the co-writer Jason Reitman, who is Ivan Reitman's son and directed the previous film, Ghostbusters Afterlife, but here he serves as a co-writer and producer, they have an affinity for Ghostbusters, and they made a sequel that could take place in the same cinematic universe as the original Ghostbusters movies, but something was missing as I was watching this film. But I'm going to get into a little bit more of the plot and what made this film unique. So, when the discovery of an ancient artifact unleashes an evil force, Ghostbusters, new and old, must join forces to protect their home, and by their home I mean New York City, and save the world from a second ice age. So this is not only the fourth movie in that Ghostbusters canon, but it's also, in a lot of respects, a sequel to Ghostbusters Afterlife, and takes on kind of the same tone while taking on a bit more of the humor of the original Ghostbusters movie. So in this film, we're reintroduced to the Spengler family, who is the family of Harold Ramis' character. There's the mother, Callie, who's played by Carrie Coon, the son, Trevor, played by Finn Wolfhard of Stranger Things fame, and daughter Phoebe, who's played by McKenna Grace. There's also Gary Gruberson, who in the original movie was an Oklahoma science teacher, and here he's played by Paul Rudd, as he was in Ghostbusters Afterlife. Well, the biggest thing that's changed from the original film, or rather Ghostbusters Afterlife, is that the entire Spengler family has moved to New York City and taken over the original headquarters of the original Ghostbusters, and also taken on the duties of the Ghostbusters. And eventually they find that there is an evil force within an ancient artifact, and there is some pretty good mythology to explain this evil force, and It's probably the best part of the movie when they do explain what's behind this evil force and what the evil force can do. But I think a lot of people who are diehard Ghostbusters fans will look at this villain and be immediately reminded of Azul from the original Ghostbusters film. And a lot of people say that Ghostbusters 2 is an inferior sequel to Ghostbusters, and I agree with that, but one of the things that set Ghostbusters 2 apart from the original Ghostbusters was not only that it had a great villain, as the original Ghostbusters did, but the villain in Ghostbusters 2 was distinctly different from Zool. And here, it just felt kind of like a Zool knockoff. As a matter of fact, it felt sort of like the villain from the Justice League film, in that it looked very much the same. And while it was certainly intimidating, and I wouldn't want to get into a fight with this evil force, I still, when the movie was done, didn't find it particularly memorable. And you also have the family here, the Spengler family, reuniting with the three living Ghostbusters, Bill Murray as Peter Venkman, Dan Aykroyd as Ray Stantz, and Ernie Hudson as Winston Zeddemore, not to mention Janine Melnitz, who's played by Annie Potts. And when they reunite, it's just not, it doesn't quite have the same sort of magic as the original four Ghostbusters, especially when the four Ghostbusters in the original movie didn't really have a ton in common. They certainly had clashing personalities, but once they started working together and they had a mission, their chemistry became readily apparent. And here, I didn't really feel like that chemistry was particularly palpable. Not to mention that there are some other characters here who are actually good additions. Like, there's a character by the name of Nadim Razmati, who's played by Kumail Nanjiani, who plays his role very well. He not only has access to these ancient artifacts that were basically hanging around his late grandmother's apartment, but he also brings them to the attention of Dan Aykroyd's character, Ray Stantz, who now runs a pawn shop and is well-versed in these kinds of archaeological finds. But I think that even though the characters here are trying to do something new with this franchise while also paying tribute to the original, sometimes I felt like while the new characters, some of them were characterized and written very well, but then there were others who were almost kind of felt like retread. As a matter of fact, Bill Murray, who reprises the role as Peter Venkman, almost says nothing that's actually funny and absolutely nothing that's particularly memorable. He also looked very tired and worn out as he was doing this film, which made me wonder if he was just doing this under contractual obligation or not. So Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, I actually did like a little bit better than Ghostbusters Afterlife. And I liked it better than Afterlife because I thought that Afterlife was trying to be Stranger Things with Finn Wolfhard in the cast and everything. It also took on the same kind of tone as Stranger Things, and I felt more like it was paying tribute to Ghostbusters rather than expanding upon the universe in a positive way and telling what would otherwise be an original story. I thought there was a nice tribute to Harold Ramis at the end, but that's all Ghostbusters Afterlife was. It was basically an elaborate tribute that they tried to make into Stranger Things simply because Stranger Things was popular. And Ghostbusters Frozen Empire does a little bit different, but it also, I think, delves a little bit too into nostalgia and also seems to incorporate Easter eggs, not for the benefit of the story, but for fan service, to appease the fans that come to these kinds of premieres dressed as their favorite Ghostbuster. So Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, I guess, could have been worse, but to me, it wasn't all that great. And I think largely it's forgettable, but it does get my rating of a marginal checkout because I did think it was certainly trying, and the people in the film who were trying, like Kumail Nanjiani, certainly are owed some kudos. But when I saw some of these other characters, especially the mini Stay Puft Marshmallow Men, who I wasn't sure were supposed to be cute or dangerous, I kind of rolled my eyes a little bit, and honestly, I didn't get into this film as much as I probably would have, but it is an improvement over Ghostbusters Afterlife in the sense that it's at least trying to be somewhat original. I just don't think it's particularly great. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Immaculate. This is a horror film, which I fortunately got the name of right the second time, about a young nun by the name of Cecilia, who's played by Sydney Sweeney, who is probably one of the last actresses that a lot of people would want to see in a habit, or at least a lot of guys, maybe some women too, given how attractive Sydney Sweeney is. But anyway, Cecilia is an American woman who is of devout faith, who is warmly welcomed to the picture-perfect Italian countryside, where she is offered a new role at an illustrious convent. But it becomes clear to Cecilia that her new home harbors dark and horrifying secrets. And this is one of those films which, if it came out before 2002, the Catholic Church would denounce it, and that would probably work for and against Immaculate's favor, because this is not a film about the dangers of Satanism. At least not obviously. As a matter of fact, it seems like the dangers are present in this Catholic convent, and that will be something that will anger some devout Catholics. But Catholics, or rather the Catholic Church at large, at least after 2002, doesn't have the same kind of sway that it did before 2002, i.e. before the Catholic Church sex scandal that really brought the Catholic Church down and from which the Catholic Church is still trying to recover. But before that, if there was an artist, like a musical artist out there, who was being sacrilegious, or if there was a controversial film that came out that was critical of the Catholic Church let everyone know about it. So whether you were a Christian who was not a Catholic, or if you went to church every Sunday, or even if you were Jewish, you felt the wrath of the Catholic Church when a movie like this came out. I know that the Catholic Church is going to denounce this film, especially when there are evil nuns in the film, as well as evil priests and archbishops, but I don't think it's going to sway people one way or the other, given the influence of the Catholic Church these days, for better or for worse. But how is it as a horror film? Well, as a horror film, it actually kind of works. It's a little bit less horror and a little bit more mystery suspense, but there are some horrific things that happen. In addition to the fact that Sydney Sweeney in this film acts incredibly well. You would think that she'd be too attractive to be a nun, but of course that's very subjective. Being devout has nothing to do with one's attractiveness, but I think actually there could be a pretty good comedy that's made out of Sydney Sweeney becoming a nun and a bunch of horny guys, maybe a couple of horny girls, who are trying to get her out of her convent and basically be with her. I think you got a good premise for a comedy there, but this movie plays it particularly well as a horror film. And the director of this film is Michael Mohan, who as a writer had previously written for a limited Netflix series, or a series that Netflix picked up but canceled after one season, called Everything Sucks. And one of the co-stars of Everything Sucks was none other than Sydney Sweeney herself. And Michael Mohan also directed 7 episodes of that show. Before this, he directed a film called The Voyeurs, which I haven't seen and therefore can't comment on. But Immaculate is not a perfect horror film. There are some parts where the film drags, and there are also some moments that are particularly unbelievable. But Sydney Sweeney, I think, does well acting here, particularly when, as pertaining to the title of this film, even though she insists that she had never been with a man before converting to the sisterhood, she becomes pregnant anyway. And the people at the convent immediately presume that her pregnancy is Immaculate Conception. In other words, that God impregnated her, and because of that, her baby could be the second coming of Christ, potentially. But as the movie progresses, you learn, especially from a charismatic priest by the name of Father Sal Tedeschi, who's played by Alvaro Morte, that this impregnation is not as holy as one would believe. And I'm not going to give away exactly what makes this conception sinister, but you get the idea from the tone of the film. And there are also some scenes in this film that made me lose my breath, including one scene at the very beginning where there is a nun who you would presume is devout who tries to escape from this convent anyway, and the sinister nuns who capture her, and that's not spoiling too much because this happens in the first 5 minutes of the film, don't kill her, but they give her a fate that's worse than death. And the fate that's worse than death is one of these Edgar Allan Poe kind of nightmares that I won't give away. But I was all on board with Sydney Sweeney's character, Sister Cecilia, as this movie was going on. And the end scene where she resolves this issue is not only very intense and reminiscent of Rosemary's Baby in a sense, but also the camera is on Sydney Sweeney and does not cut away for what seems to be about 5 straight minutes. Maybe it's a little bit more, maybe it's a little bit less. I didn't time it, but I was just mesmerized by it as I was watching it, because Sydney Sweeney goes through a whole gamut of emotions. And I really think that people should take this performance seriously, if not the movie. Because there are some silly parts of the movies, and there are some other parts of this film that makes you kind of question if this would actually happen in real life. And there are some other parts where the jump scares seem kind of cheap, but I still got on board with this movie, especially considering that it's about a church that's still very controversial. It has a lot of history. It has centuries upon centuries of not exactly being friendly. And it also could be conceived as a cult to some people. Being raised Catholic myself, I wouldn't go as far as to say that the Catholic Church is a cult, because that's saying a lot and definitely throwing stones at glass houses. But the movie Immaculate is a movie that will certainly upset some people, but the people who can get past the controversy it raises here would certainly be taken in by the film, and almost definitely by Sydney Sweeney's performance. This is why I give Immaculate my rating of a checkout. It probably would have been more of a knockout if it had trusted its more instincts for a horror story and not thrown in a lot of those jump scares. And the sign of a really good horror film for me is when I could put my, is when I feel no choice but to put my hands over my eyes. And I didn't do that once when I was watching Immaculate. My hands stayed exactly by my sides, but I could appreciate some of the strengths of this film because it could have been a lot worse. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Kung Fu Panda 4. And this is, of course, the fourth series, the third sequel to the 2008 box office smash, Kung Fu Panda, which I was not only entertained by when I went to see it back in 2008, but I also absolutely loved it. I thought Jack Black was perfectly cast as Po. And in this film, Po is still the Dragon Warrior, but he is tapped to become the spiritual leader of the Valley of Peace. And in becoming the spiritual leader, that means he needs to relinquish his previous role, which he has not only been appointed to, but also earned in his own right, particularly in the first film. But before he does that, he needs to find and train a new dragon warrior, while a wicked sorceress known as the Chameleon plans to resummon all the master villains whom Po has vanquished to the spiritual realm in the previous three films. So Jack Black returns to this movie as Po, the panda. Dustin Hoffman returns as Shifu, the red panda, who looks a little bit more like a rodent. I'm not sure if a red panda is exactly a rodent, but it could most certainly be mistaken for one. Not returning to this film are the members of the Furious Five, with the exception of one of the voice actors, whom I won't give away. But a lot of the major voice actors of the Furious Five do not come back for this movie. And why they don't come back, I don't exactly know, because they were in the previous three Kung Fu Panda movies. Obviously, they have to be established in the first one. But surprisingly enough, one of the villains of Po's past, Tai Lung, who's voiced by Ian McShane, returns here. And that's when the villain of this film, the main antagonist, the Chameleon, who's voiced by Viola Davis, is not only able to shapeshift and probably becomes the most dangerous villain that Po has faced yet, but she also is obsessed with having the power of A, opening up the secret realm of the dead, and B, taking the powers of all the villains whom Po had conquered in the previous films. Also returning to this film is James Hong, who voices the goose and adopted father of Po, Mr. Ping, and also from the previous film, Kung Fu Panda 3, Lee, who is a panda who is Po's real father, who's voiced by Bryan Cranston, also makes an appearance in this film. And actually, even though Bryan Cranston is a great actor, I honestly forgot a lot of the new characters in Kung Fu Panda 3. Unlike the original Kung Fu Panda that I've seen probably about four or five times at this point, I only saw parts 2 and 3 once each. And I don't really remember them all that well. But would Kung Fu Panda 4 be better because I remember it better than the other two? I can't exactly say for sure, and I'm not exactly one to rank this film. I do have to say, though, that the animation is still excellent, and the DreamWorks animators, like many of the previous films that they've done, and the bigger budget films like the Shrek films, are very articulate when it comes to the detail, the very, very small details of the lands that Po travels, as well as the fibers of fur on Po's body. And in this film, since Po is indecisive about finding a new dragon warrior, he takes on the role of the dragon warrior one more time to find this terrorist known as the Chameleon, and he enlists the help of a fox by the name of Zen, who's voiced by Awkwafina, who is an expert thief and a con artist. And Awkwafina has done so many character voices in so many animated and some live-action films with animated elements over the last couple of years. And initially I thought, when I knew that Awkwafina was voicing a character here, here we go again. My God, there's not an animated film in which she hasn't acted, although that's not entirely true, but it's good that they have more Asian American actors in this film. Not only Awkwafina, but also Kehui Kwan does a creature by the name of Han, and there's also Ronnie Cheng, who does the voice of a fish who plays a pivotal role in Poe and Zen finding the chameleon and also bringing her to justice, or at least attempting to do so. And once the story gets going, I think that Poe and Zen not only make a great team, but they also work very well off of each other, and their personalities can be readily apparent here. Not only the fact that they confide in each other, but also they trust each other as well for various parts of this film. And I did not expect that Viola Davis would play a villain in this film. And she's actually been playing some villains here and there, most notably in some live action films. But here, I didn't initially recognize her as the chameleon, but the chameleon was such a great character and probably the best villain in the Kung Fu Panda franchise so far. And that's saying a lot, because Ian McShane's Tai Lung not only was a very expertly voiced villain, but he also was evil in kind of a Darth Vader kind of way in the original film. But to see him reprise his character is great here, but the chameleon is really the big draw of this film. And I was immensely entertained by Kung Fu Panda 4. There's one part in the very end during the end credits where Tenacious D sing a version of Britney Spears' song Baby One More Time, which I wasn't crazy about, because Britney Spears' original song is already great as it is. And not only is the song not really a great fit for Kung Fu Panda 4, but hearing Tenacious D sing it feels kind of tacky. And this is coming from a big Tenacious D fan, especially one of the few people who went to see that film, The Pick of Destiny, which I've seen 5 or 6 times more since the first time I've seen it, and I still think it's a funny stoner comedy. But regardless, I'm not going to bring this film down just because the ending song wasn't that great a choice. I'm bringing this film up because Jack Black is still solid as the voice of Poe. I think he works incredibly well alongside every other character in this film who voices their characters. I also liked some of the subplots, like the dynamic between Mr. Ping, Poe's adopted father, and Lee, Poe's estranged and real father, and the fact that he comes into his life and also gets along very well with Mr. Ping as they're trying to save Poe from potentially making a big mistake. I thought that was a good subplot. And I also thought that some of the other side characters, especially the characters of Fish and Han, worked very well in this film. It didn't seem like they were easily entertaining some of the little kids. So Kung Fu Panda 4 is a movie to which I give my rating of a knockout. I think it is very well cast in terms of voice, extremely well animated. It probably is the best sequel to the original Kung Fu Panda. It doesn't beat the original Kung Fu Panda, because that one is really hard to beat, but I still think it is more than commendable, because a lot of the characters here, even the smaller ones, are really well fleshed out, and the chameleon is probably the best villain in the entire Kung Fu Panda franchise. For that reason, I absolutely loved Kung Fu Panda 4, and it's good to see a movie like this enter into the fourth chapter after 16 years and still have a lot of juice, a lot of that drive that makes Kung Fu Panda 4 one of the best franchises in animation. And I mean that. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The American Society of Magical Negroes, which is a film that when I first heard the title of the film, it immediately made me laugh. And I know that the magical Negro is a trope, and the term itself was coined by Spike Lee in 2001, particularly when he was expressing some frustration about this trope that's apparent in movies like The Green Mile, where you have Michael Clark Duncan's character, John Coffey, who is a convict who has magical healing powers, and also the movie The Legend of Bagger Vance, where Will Smith plays this type as well, who makes it his mission to improve the golf game of Matt Damon's character. And I initially didn't have a problem with a character like this, but Spike Lee's reasoning in how dehumanizing this kind of movie trope is and how it sets Hollywood back a few decades is a good point, and he does have some valid arguments as to why this trope can be potentially harmful and dehumanizing. So, The American Society of Magical Negroes is not directed by Spike Lee, although it could have been. At the same time, Spike Lee hasn't directed a comedy in quite some time, but it is directed by and written by a first-time director by the name of Kobe Libby, who is African-American himself. And the movie is about a young man whose name is Aaron, who's played by Justice Smith, who is recruited into a secret society of magical black people who dedicate their lives to the cause of utmost importance. And just giving a little bit of a pause, this is utmost importance to this group, not utmost importance to society. So this utmost importance is subjective. And the utmost importance is making white people's lives easier. And remember, this is the synopsis, not my opinion here. And Aaron is a struggling artist who befriends somebody at one of his art showings by the name of Roger, who's played by David Alan Greer. And Roger looks to be a bartender, but there's a lot more to him than meets the eye. And Aaron begins to see what kind of magical powers that Roger has, and Roger inexplicably wants to recruit Aaron into his American Society of Magical Negroes. And from here, you learn a little bit more about the magical Negro trope. They don't use footage from movies that I mentioned, like Song of the South, the Legend of Bagger Vance, or The Green Mile, but they do use some scenes that are meant to indirectly parody these kinds of movies. But from there, the clever premise doesn't really take off. As a matter of fact, Justice Smith is an actor who I've seen in several movies and TV shows for quite some time, and he is an excellent actor when it comes to being in dramatic films, for example, or dramatic series. For example, there was a limited series that Netflix put out back in 2016 called The Get Down, which was developed by Baz Luhrmann. That limited series was excellent. It took place in New York City in the late 1970s, circa 77 to 78, and it made New York City look like a dump, which it was in the 70s, but it also showed that out of the ashes and the scrap heaps of New York came a great new form of music. And I thought that Justice Smith played his character very well and is torn between getting a great education or riding this wave of this new lifestyle that would ultimately take the world by storm. But in the late 1970s, it was relegated to the Bronx. And I've also seen Justice Smith act well in some other big franchise films like the recent Dungeons and Dragons movie from last year and Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, the latter of which was not a great film, but he was good in it. But in this film, he seemed lost. He didn't really seem to know what other emotion to play besides just being confused. And I would imagine that if you were going to be recruited into a group called the American Society of Magical Negroes, that would require some versatility and some charisma. Now, those are traits that David Alan Greer has, no doubt. It also is a trait that Will Smith has, certainly, although now Will Smith is box office poison thanks to a decision he made at one of the Oscar ceremonies, but that is another story for another time. But it seems like Justice Smith's character Aaron is recruited into the society, and he's also recruited to be a magical Negro to a guy who works at a company that's like Facebook. His name is Jason, and he's played by Drew Tarver. And initially, Aaron is drawn to a woman who works there by the name of Lizzie, who's played by a relatively newcoming actress by the name of Ann Lee Bogan, who is not a particularly well-known actress. She hasn't been in many mainstream films before this one, but she certainly has a lot of versatility to her. And conflict arises when Aaron is told by Jason that he likes his coworker Lizzie. So initially, this is a good way to start a love triangle, but eventually the romantic comedy element of this film overtakes what would otherwise be a pretty good sort of fantasy science fiction comedy. And that's where the movie really loses its footing. But on top of that, other than David Alan Greer's character, a lot of the characters in this film are grossly underdeveloped. Like, for example, I wanted to hear more about some of the other people who worked in this magical Negro society, particularly the head of the magical Negroes, Dee Dee, who's played by comedian Nicole Byer. And even though Nicole Byer is a very versatile comedian, she's not developed particularly well as a character either. And for that matter, Justice Smith's character, and this may be the fault of the writer and director, not Justice Smith himself, isn't developed either. You know he's an artist, but you don't exactly know what draws him to art until way too late in the film. You also learn from his speaking his lines that he has a white mother, and you would think that his upbringing would be a good development for his character here. But no, he just kind of drops that he has a white mother, or sort of says that he has one, and then the subject is dropped further on. And also, I thought it was troubling that Justice Smith in this movie is the only member of the American Society of Magical Negroes who's lighter skinned. And being a white person, I'm not one to discuss the validity of colorism in movies, but I do know that it is an issue in movies, particularly those with a large African-American cast. And it made me wonder, especially when we live in a society and there are movies that are coming out of Hollywood that don't have as many dark-skinned characters as you would think, that the lead character probably shouldn't be lighter skin. But again, that's another topic that would take probably volumes of books to explain accurately, not the 10-minute segment that I dedicate to a given movie. The problem is, this movie is troubled in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of people would take issue with the fact that this society was created to make white people happy so they wouldn't kill black people. And I think that delicate topic is covered way too haphazardly here, and with a wink and a smile that feels inappropriate, even coming from David Alan Greer. So the American Society of Magical Negroes is an uneven comedy that could have been not only a good satire, but also a really good fantasy, as well as a sort of recruitment style franchise along the same kind of lines as Men in Black. But it just, faltered in a lot of scenes. There were scenes that should have been funny that ultimately fell flat. And I wouldn't exactly blame Justice Smith for his performance here, but I couldn't exactly decide if his character was underdeveloped or he was miscast. But maybe it was both in this case, which is why I give the American Society of Magical Negroes my rating of a strikeout. It's a film that's very ambitious, but its ambition is ultimately confused by a muddled plot. And there were moments in this film that I chuckled, but none of the gut-busting laughs that I really think a film of this title would have merited. I think that David Alan Grier was probably the best actor in this film and the most developed, but there were dozens, if not nearly hundreds of other characters who should have been more developed in this film, and Justice Smith didn't do this movie, if you'll excuse the pun, justice with his role in it. He lacked charisma and he lacked character development, and overall that really hurt the film more than any other controversy the film would. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is a low-budget indie film by the name of The Sweet East. This is a film that is described as a satirical, surrealist road film, and I probably couldn't explain that any better myself. It's directed by first-time director Sean Price Williams, who previously had done cinematography for other independent films. Most notably, he did cinematography for a film that I saw 2 years ago that was Owen Klein's directorial debut, which was called Funny Pages. And that's a movie that is jarring in a lot of sense. It's certainly a black comedy, but it's a film that I largely didn't forget. And there are shots in this film that reminded me of the movie Funny Pages, even though a lot of people have largely forgotten or haven't seen the movie Funny Pages. But this movie is about a high school student by the name of Lillian, who's played by a relative newcomer of an actress by the name of Talia Ryder, who is on a class trip to Washington, D.C., and is at a local restaurant that is attacked by an armed man who believes the establishment houses a secret pedophile ring. And she is led to safety by a left-wing political activist who brings her to a home where he lives with other dissidents. And from there, she eventually travels with a number of misfits, including one right-wing professor, and also some very ambitious filmmakers who see star quality in her and want to put her in a movie. And those filmmakers, by the way, are played by Jeremy O. Harris and Ayo Edebiri. And I've been pronouncing Ayo Edebiri's name wrong. It was only until she hosted SNL that I knew that her last name was pronounced Edebiri, not Edebiri. So my apologies about that, but I do come along non-American last names all the time. I give it my best shot in terms of pronouncing, so I hope nobody's offended. But this movie does have a great cast, and Ayo Edebiri is in this film, and this is her fifth film in which she has acted in 2023. How that woman finds time to sleep, I just don't know. But The Sweet East is definitely a road film, and this girl in the film, Lillian, disappears, and there's very good reason that she disappears, because when she's at this Washington, D.C. restaurant, she's in danger. So the fact that she kind of goes in hiding, but then kind of goes all along the Northeast, in sort of an Alice in Wonderland type trip where she encounters a lot of misfits, but still manages to get through it without getting hurt or getting raped or killed, is probably the most fantastical part of this film. But even though it might not exactly be realistic, it's still a lot of fun to watch, and you never exactly know what's going to happen next. And that's probably in large part due to the writing of Nick Pinkerton, who wrote the story and the screenplay for this film. Why he decided to have a female protagonist, I don't exactly know, but it works. But I would just imagine that a woman being the protagonist of such a story would have more vulnerability than a male would. I mean, in reality. But the movie kind of works because you sort of delve into the fantastical elements. You also see Lillian make some very poor choices in what she does in her journeys, but you're also kind of rooting for her to land on her feet. And surprisingly, in this movie, she always does. And The Sweet East is a film which has some cinematography that might be kind of frustrating for some people to watch. There's an overdependence of close-ups, but I had that same complaint with the movie Funny Pages, which Sean Price Williams also provided the cinematography for that film as well. But overall, I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was very quirky. It's listed as a drama, but there are a number of very funny parts in this film. As a matter of fact, Jeremy O'Harris and Io Edebiri probably have the biggest moments of comic relief here. You also have Jacob Elordi in this film as well, and he, like Io Edebiri, has had a fantastic 2023 when it's come to being in films, and he's not exactly an A-lister yet, but in probably a few months, if not a few years, he will be. But if it hadn't been for some of the familiar faces in this film, like Simon Rex, Io Edebiri, and Jacob Elordi, I probably would think this film was a documentary. But the fact that these well-known people are in the film certainly took me out of the documentary feel, but I think some other people might be fooled by this being a documentary. And they might get angry and think to themselves, why doesn't this guy put down the camera and help this poor woman get home? It's kind of funny when you think about it, but The Sweet East is a film that is certainly low budget, but it has a great independent spirit to it, which makes it get my rating of a knockout. It certainly has some cinematography that can be frustrating sometimes, but coming from Sean Price Williams, it also is very iconic of his cinematography style, and I can certainly respect that. Although, if you do have motion sickness, I would recommend taking Dramamine before seeing this film. But otherwise, it does have a priceless quality for being a low-budget film. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And now that I've reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show, it's now time for me to get into my final segment, which is what's coming up next. This is a spoken word preview of movies that are subject to being released in theaters, in this case on March 29th, 2024. And normally I'd also tell you what's coming out on streaming, but I don't think I have time for that for this show. So there are a number of movies that are coming out in theaters on March 29th or are subject to be released. The biggest one is a movie that's called Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire. This is not only the fourth film in this Godzilla King Kong cinematic universe, but it is the second time in which Godzilla and King Kong go after each other. Or maybe not King Kong, maybe he's just known as Kong. This is a sequel to the 2021 film Godzilla vs. Kong, which I saw and I honestly didn't really like it. I thought that the Godzilla film from 2015, which starred Bryan Cranston, Aaron Taylor Johnson, and Elizabeth Olsen, was excellent, but I wasn't impressed by the Kong Skull Island film that came out in 2017 or Godzilla King of the Monsters. But this is a franchise that definitely has some steam, and two ancient titans, Godzilla and Kong, clash in an epic battle as humans unravel their intertwined origins and connections to Skull Island's mysteries. So I'm not exactly sure what the new empire is. If Godzilla and Kong actually create this new empire, I don't exactly know. But the movie has an impressive cast, including Rebecca Hall, Brian Tyree Henry, Dan Stevens, Kaylee Hoddle, and others. This is a movie that I will see. I kind of have a muddled expectation for this one based on how Godzilla vs. Kong should have been a great movie but was ultimately forgettable, I'm sorry to say. But I'll see it and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that's coming out in theaters on March 29th is a film that's called In the Land of Saints and Sinners. And this is a film that looks like it has a lot of promise. It takes place in Ireland, and Liam Neeson co-stars in it. So Liam Neeson is finally playing an Irishman after how long? Jeez, I mean, it's probably been nearly 30 years. The last time I remember him playing an Irishman in Ireland was the movie Michael Collins. And that film came out in 1996. So this movie takes place in a remote Irish village where a damaged father is forced to fight for redemption after a lifetime of sins. But what price is he willing to pay? In the land of saints and sinners, some sins can't be buried. So the movie stars, in addition to Liam Neeson, Kerry Condon, who is another Irish actress who was nominated for The Banshees of Inisherin. It also stars Desmond Eastwood, Connor McNeil, and Seamus O'Hara, as well as Kieran Hines. So a lot of notable Irish actors in this film, plus Liam Neeson being a notable Irish actor himself. But I am really hoping in this film that Liam Neeson does not play the same guy he's been playing in so many forgettable American films of yesteryear. As a matter of fact, Liam Neeson has been in so many forgettable action films that I dedicated a category in my worst films of 2022 that was called Liam Neeson Enough Already. I think Liam Neeson is a fantastic actor, and he deserves his accolades that he's gotten, but his acting career has been in kind of Charles Bronson autopilot. He's always played the tough aging assassin who has one more crime to do before he retires or dies, and it's tired. But I'm hoping In the Land of Saints and Sinners is a better film than the crap that Liam Neeson has done over the last couple of years. But it is a film that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Although I will say, it was a missed opportunity for this film not to come out on St. Patrick's Day weekend, but what can you do? Another film that is subject to being released in theaters nationwide on March 29th is a movie that's called La Chimera. Let me say that again. The film is called La Chimera, and it is about a group of archaeologists and the black market of historical artifacts. It is not a documentary, but it is an adventure comedy fantasy. It stars Josh O'Connor, Carol Duarte, and other such actors. It's a film. Oh, and Isabella Rossellini is in it too. It's a film that I might see. I don't know if it's coming out in a theater near me, but if I see it, I'll let you know what I think on a future show.
Well, that's all the time I have for this episode of Words on Film. I always love talking about movies, and I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and rate the show and leave comments if you can. I would love to get your feedback, even if it's more criticism than praise. This has been Words on Film. I'm Dan Burke, and until my next episode, I'll see you at the movies.